Hello and welcome to Tulsa Beacon Weekend. I'm your host, Charlie Biggs, publisher of the Tulsa Beacon newspaper, Tulsa's family newspaper. And joining us in studio is Andrew Pudawa, who is a director of the Institute for Excellence in Writing. Andrew, it's great to have you on the show.
Great to be with you, Charlie.
I'm going to keep referring to you as Andrew, because I'm going to mess up your last name, I know.
Sure.
Anyway, I'm glad that you're on the show right now, because we are on the eve of the start of school. In August, all the moms and dads are thinking about, well, actually, this weekend is the tax-free weekend. So if you want to buy clothes for your kids, it's any item under $100 is no tax on. And it's interesting because it's also no tax in Missouri and Texas. But please stay here in Oklahoma and spend your money. But anyway, tell us what your institute does.
Well, I am the director of the Institute for Excellence in Writing. And our work is to assist parents and teachers in helping children learn to speak and write the English language better.
Amen, brother. I tell you, we have a everything from Ebonics to there is such a problem these days with kids knowing how to communicate. Not only orally, but especially in the printed word. You see that as a growing problem?
Oh, absolutely. I travel a lot, so I sit on airplanes and talk to businessmen, managers, supervisors, you know, men and women who have to hire high school and college graduates. And I would say the single most common complaint is they can't write. They can't write well enough to do a job in the real world. How did they get out of college without being able to string three complete sentences together? It's almost universal complaint, problem. Even college professors wonder, how did these kids get into college?
I had a conversation a few years ago with one of the top executives of AT&T in Oklahoma, and he asked him what his degree was in. He said, my undergraduate degree was in journalism, and he had an MBA and then extras. He said, but when I hire somebody, I would rather hire somebody with a degree in journalism than a degree in business, because the journalist can come into a room, into a meeting, and boil down the essence and talk about what we really need to be communicated. Whereas sometimes the MBAs, the BBAs, those guys come in and they kind of like to hear themselves talk, like to use big words. And I'm sure particularly in education circles, the clarity sometimes is lost due to trying to use big words and trying to impress people. You think that's fair to say that?
Well, I think every profession has its lingo.
Right.
But some sets of lingo seem to obfuscate meaning more than others. And kids, of course, are living in a very different world than professional adults. So their language is coming from media, you know, television, internet. It's coming from peers.
Right.
And so it's not very reasonable for anyone to expect that you would get out of a brain something that isn't in there to begin with. So if students don't have a good source of reliably correct and relatively sophisticated English coming into their brain, well, however are they going to speak and write with reliably correct and sophisticated English?
So whatever goes in comes out.
That's the bottom line. Brains are pretty simple in that way.
I had a dear friend, a pastor of mine, years ago here in Tulsa, who was working on his doctorate and his thesis, and he sent it in to his professor, and it was very well researched and very smart, and it came back, it looked like a bottle of red ink had fallen on the document, and he handed it to me, and it said at the top, don't send this back until somebody else looks at it. And so he gave it to me, and I said, okay, let me look at it. And I edited it for him, and I told him, I said, you know, the problem is you're writing like you talk, and we don't talk in a very disciplined manner, and we should write in a more disciplined manner. And he wasn't concise, and it was he was a good preacher, by the way, but it's more of a discipline, you know, to sit down and to communicate. And really, that's the goal, isn't it? I've had people say, you know, newspapers are aimed at an eighth grade level. And some people say, oh, eighth graders, you know. But really, the goal is not what grade level it is. It's the communicating to a larger audience.
Mm-hmm. Well, and certainly the discipline of committing ideas to paper in an organized, consistently correct way that anyone can read and understand is it requires more effort. You know, if you and I sit here and talk to each other, we can see each other's faces, we have gestures. There are a lot of non-verbal things that assist in our communication understanding. On paper, we don't have that backup. We have to write it in such a way that everything comes through, the complete idea, the syntax. There's little room for carelessness or sloppiness if what we want is correctness and precision.
And everybody I've talked to over the course of my newspaper career, and I've said, how do you get better as a writer? The one common element is write, do it, get better, you know. And so many kids now, they just shy away from writing. They don't want to do it. And I tell you, it's a big problem. I've talked to some college professors because there's a lot of copying that goes on. There's so much information on the internet, and there's cheating, basically. And I guess there are even programs that professors use to find out if a paper has been, you know, copied.
Oh, not only colleges and universities, but high schools now do it. And the institutions will subscribe to a service that has a database of all known papers, and they will submit the papers electronically. The computer will compare the student's paper against the database of all known papers, and if there's a 60% word or phrase repeat, it'll flag it as possible plagiarism. It'll then add that paper to the database of known papers, which is continually growing. So, yes, it is a tremendous problem. And the funny thing, Charlie, is that kids who get caught having, say, bought a paper or using a paper that someone else wrote, they don't actually feel like they've cheated. They don't have a conscience that differentiates between using technology and using technology to do something yourself.
Right.
Now, of course, the world gets around the problems, and I understand there are people who will write completely original papers for you. So you can, you know, avoid the plagiarism problem.
Right.
I think there's guys in India who'd be happy to write you great papers for $10 a page. So, you know, fear not. If you have to go to college and write papers, you can get by even if you can't.
You're listening to Tulsa Beacon Weekend. I'm your host, Charlie Biggs, publisher of the Tulsa Beacon newspaper, Tulsa's family newspaper. And if you want to find out some more about the tax burden in Tulsa County, you know, we have in November, we're going to have a vote for a bond issue that could be in the neighborhood of $909 million, almost $1 billion. We have a report on that at the Beacon. Pick up a copy of Tulsa Area Quick Trips or call 918-523-4425. 918-523-4425 will sell you a subscription or go online. And this is very difficult to remember, but it's TulsaBeacon.com. I'm just kidding. And we're talking with Andrew Padua, who is the director of the Institute for Excellence in Writing. And how can they contact your group?
Well, we have a website, yourchildcanwrite.com, and we introduce people to some of our materials that will help parents and teachers help children to learn to put words on paper in a more organized and sophisticated, articulate way. That's our specialty.
So if you had parents, and I'm sure this has happened, parents come to you and say, you know, I wish I could help my child develop better communication skills, particularly better writing skills, become a better reader. What's your advice to them?
Number one piece of advice, don't stop reading out loud to children, even when they start reading on their own. You know, we tend to favor younger children.
Right.
And, you know, I had a relatively big family, 7 children. And usually what happens is in a family, the goal is for the children to start reading on their own. And then we say, aha, that's great. You know, you can read. So you go do Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe to yourself, which will free me up to do Ping and the Beautiful Yangtze River here one more time with the 4-year-old. Do you know Ping?
Right.
You know, it's a true classic. And so we tend to favor the younger children. But I would argue it is when children begin to read on their own, when their decoding skills are starting to click, they most need to be read to at a level above their own decoding skills. Because that's how you'll build vocabulary, you'll build language patterns, you'll build comprehension by reading out loud to children in huge quantity. If I could get, you know, every American family to do one thing, read out loud to the whole family, all the kids, at a level above the top kid in the room every day for half an hour. That right there could transform America from an increasingly non-literate society to an increasingly literate society.
What would be your counsel to a teacher that has a class full of students that where they haven't been read to, they haven't read out loud, and she's coming in August, and she's got this? What would you say to her?
Well, there'd be two things. One is steal some time. You know, steal some time from some aspect of what a teacher is kind of required to do. And, of course, we know with this idea of standards, and it's even getting bigger with the Common Core and all that.
Teach to test.
Teach to the test. But oftentimes what children really need isn't easily testable. And so reading out loud 20 minutes a day, couldn't the teacher steal that? In fact, a lot of folks, you know, older folks like us, yeah, will say, well, that was the best part of school. You know, I remember we'd come in after recess and put our heads on the desk, and, you know, Miss Rucker would read to us for 20 minutes from a chapter book. That was the best part of the day. And yet teachers today so often are so busy, they feel like they can't, you know, legally steal the time from the test prep treadmill, if you will, to do that. So see if you know, teachers, see if you can steal some time, get a book you love, let the kids just relax, doodle, put their head down, and read for 20 minutes a day. It could make a huge difference. Second thing would be teachers can encourage parents. You know, teachers can set up a system. They meet with parents. They have parent days. They can send letters home. They can really encourage parents. Turn off the TV and read to your students every night. Read to your children every night. That would be my one big wish.
When I was in school, in high school, I had an English teacher who I dearly loved, and she she taught a literature class, and she would have people come up to the front and read, you know, chapters out of these books, and there were about four or five guys in our class who were not really straight in the head. but we like to get up there, you know, and mm-hmm. and you know, in fact, if we get up there, and like if we were doing Oliver Twist or something like that, we would read, start, you know, trying to do an accent, you know, and, yeah, and but it was reading out front, and I had a Spanish teacher for 3 years in junior high, and her goal was to get the class to where we only spoke in Spanish during the class, and we also would get up and read, you know, and she's and most kids just wouldn't do it, you know, but you know, some of us that did get up and would read. It stayed with us here in our old age, you know, even in a church setting, you know, when I just got through a session with our youth group, leading them in about a year and a half, and we would start the class by looking at a text, at least a chapter of the Bible, and I would ask somebody to read it, and it would be different people each time. And part of it was so that everybody would hear it, but also part that the person reading would develop, you know, a little bit more because of reading something in front of a group. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. We might call it locution skills or elocution. This, interestingly, used to be something that was consciously taught in schools. I even saw a report card from 1904, a school report card, and there were some subjects which were notably missing on the report card. For example, there was no social studies. There was history and geography, but no social studies. Mm-hmm. Also missing was sex ed. I don't know how they learned that stuff back then. But what was on the report card, a few things you wouldn't see likely today, elocution. Right. And so from a young age, children were required to memorize poetry and scripture and stand up and recite it in front of a group, to read well out loud from a classic literature, than to even memorize famous speeches from history and recite them and then write their own speeches.
Does that go on now?
I don't think too much. I think that modern education has kind of marginalized memorization as a valuable skill. And yet it's retained, you know, in the Christian tradition. We are more likely to see the value of memorizing scripture. But children 150 years ago were responsible for huge chunks of memorized scripture, poetry, famous speeches. In fact, that's how That's how you actually proved you knew something. You would recite it. There's a expression. Have you read a little book like books like Little House on the Prairie, Anne of Green Gables, about that whole time period? There's an expression used often. I have to go to school and say my lessons. Have you ever heard that?
No, I haven't heard
to
that.
To say my lessons. It was a common thing kids would say. But now, of course, nobody would go to school and say their lesson. You got to go to school and take multiple guest tests on a Scantron or a tablet.
Well, you know, I memorized The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere when I was a kid. And I could probably recite it now. Time doesn't permit, so I won't do that, you know. But and I can remember some limericks that a teacher one year, she said, here's a first line, write a limerick. You know, and I can still remember some of those limericks, you know. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I've had at church we learned Bible verses, and those stick with you. But it seems like that's kind of evaporated a little bit.
Well, what happened really was the modern influence kind of began with John Dewey, famous educationist, University of Chicago. And he had this kind of experimental school, and he wrote some, you know, interesting, insightful things, but he had a very, very bad concept of things like memorization, rote learning, drill, copy work, things that sounded
diagramming sentences.
Uncreative. Yes, grammar.
Yeah.
That somehow doing this was going to stifle children's creativity and imagination.
Right.
But what he failed to notice, and this is really being rediscovered a bit in the world of Christian classical education, is that young children are kind of wired for memorization. If you don't give them good stuff to memorize, they'll memorize garbage.
Oh, yeah.
Rap songs, you know, stupid lines from movies.
Like a sponge.
Yeah. So memorization is not a de facto bad thing for children. It's actually a natural function of children's minds. And so what I would hope is that, you know, teachers and parents would understand the value of memorization, both from a discipline building the brain point of view. Because, I mean, let's face it, you are probably smarter because you memorized the great, huge, long poem, Paul Revere's Ride.
Right.
You build a vocabulary. You probably develop some discipline, much like you have to do in, say, music or dance. You have to discipline your mind to memorize. And then, of course, it built into your mind language patterns that can come out in your work as a professional writer and speaker.
You're listening to Tulsa Beacon Weekend. I'm your host, Charlie Biggs, publisher of the Tulsa Beacon newspaper, Tulsa's family newspaper. And if you want to find out about the city's plans to pick up those broken tree limbs in your front yard, we have a report on the Beacon this week. Pick up a copy of Tulsa Area Quick Trips or call 918-523-4425. 918-523-4425, and we'll say subscription or go online at TulsaBeacon.com. We're talking with Andrew Padua, who is the director of the Institute for Excellence in Writing. Tell us again, what is the Institute and what do you guys do?
Well, we have basically two functions. We do teacher training, and we also work with homeschool groups around the country. So we do training in a system of structure and style in composition. So we teach parents and teachers how to teach children to write better.
And a contact information would be?
Yourchildcanwrite.com.
We're approaching the start of school, and there are a lot of parents, a lot of Christian parents that are thinking, wow, what am I going to do? Am I going to send my kid to public school? Am I going to send my kid to a private school? Or am I going to send my children to a private Christian school? Am I going to homeschool my kids? These are very weighty decisions for parents that are very deeply interested in the development of their children. In terms of the development of writing skills, how does that all flesh out?
That's a great question. Of course, this is an interesting time to work in the world of education because there are more options today than really ever before for a century. And so parents can look at different options for schools or education. I work in this area of teaching writing. And Mortimer Adler, who was kind of a pioneer in the classical education rebirth in the 1900s, if you will, he identified three things that we have to teach and learn in the world of education: knowledge or information, concepts, and skills. And these are really three things that are interrelated but different in their nature. For example, information. If I would like you to learn, you know, all of the presidents of the United States, I could give you a list and I could say, please memorize this list in order and I will test you on it in a couple weeks. Right. That would just be raw information. And it would be fair to say the goal is to memorize it, practice it till you know it, I will test you on it, and then give you, say, a percentage. So if you got 90% of the presidents, okay, you get 90%, maybe we'll call that an A. That's a limited, finite set of information. And that's pretty easy to kind of administer. You know, you can give information, you can practice it with kids, and then you can evaluate how well they can remember it, at least for a short period of time. Concepts are a little trickier, aren't they?
Right.
For example, what percentage of the concept of inflation do you understand? Well, you could not answer that because the concept of inflation is infinite. You could spend your whole life studying it. Some people have.
Right.
So concepts, not being finite, require more than just information. They require understanding, and therefore they require discussion. They require us to talk about something and build a foundation, then add more information based on that foundation. And we can't just give information without the foundation, because then it doesn't stick, learning doesn't happen. Skills are really very different from both of those. Skills are things you do. They usually end in ing: swimming, painting, playing music, writing. And skills you can't learn either by memorization or by discussion. I don't think I could talk you into playing the violin.
No.
I'd have to get you a violin, and we'd have to start at the beginning of a pathway and work up that pathway.
Right.
Now, here's what Adler pointed out, and here's a great, this is a dilemma for every school, you know, public, private, even homeschooled, is it's easy to administer and test information.
Right.
It's harder to do that with concepts, and it's virtually impossible to do that with skills.
Right.
But because you can do that with a multiple choice test or a, you know, an easy to grade thing, a lot of cases we try to teach concepts and skills as if they were information.
Okay.
And that generally fails.
So what do you, how do you solve that?
Well, understanding the nature of each of these things. Skills, of course, is where we work because we teach writing. It's right. Something you have to do. I think earlier in the show, you said, you know, the way to learn to write is to write. You can't read books about how to do it
right.
And learn to do it any more than you could read a book about how to swim and learn to swim.
Right.
Now, information is important. Concepts are important. But coached practice is the key to developing a skill. And you think, yeah, you know, kids go to music lessons. What does the music teacher do? Coached practice. You know, they go to sports. What do they have? They don't have a teacher of football. They have a coach of football, right?
Well, my daughter just graduated from high school, and she was for 4 years involved in the robotics program at Memorial High School, which was they put together a robot every year, and they went down and had competition. And now she's going to major in engineering in college, you know.
Wonderful.
But that, I think that's kind of what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's a skill. And so then how do you get coached practice? Well, you have to have a coach who can show you what to do, and then you try to imitate the coach.
Right.
And then the coach can refine your imitation of that until you can do that particular little thing pretty much as well as the coach or close to it. And then the coach takes you to the next step in the process, and through it's a process of modeling, imitation, feedback, and refinement. Modeling, imitation, feedback, and refinement, and it's an endless spiral there.
We just about have a couple minutes left. If somebody is listening to this and think, wow, I really need this, can you help them?
We can. We have also video courses. And while they're not quite as good as, you know, a live coach, What we do know is that the first few steps in this pathway of becoming a good writer are pretty consistent for everyone. It's not a mystery. And our system of teaching writing is based on imitation. So we start with content, show the children how to move the content from the text into what we would call a keyword outline, and then how to retell that content from the keyword outline. This is somewhat analogous to learning a particular piece of music. You know, we kind of teach writing in this country, you know, just write whatever, just, you know, spew your thoughts, express yourself on paper. If we taught music that way, it goes something like this. Sure, come on in, love to teach you the piano, teach you all the names of the notes, how to press the keys, how to use the pedals. But there is one little rule here. You can't play anything that anyone else ever played. You have to kind of make everything up and be completely original. And of course, this is not how great writers, you know, from ancient times learned. Imitation is the key to stepping on the pathway of a skill. And creativity is generally the result of a combination permutation of many, many, many existing language patterns or music patterns or movement patterns. So we start in a very sane way. It's tried and true. It's been around for a couple thousand years or more. And it's unfortunately been lost with the modernism in education, but it can easily be learned and used. We've got materials for parents, teachers, and students.
Well, we've been talking with Andrew Poudlewa, who is the director of the Institute for Excellence in Writing. Your website and telephone number?
Yourchildcanwrite.com, and you can see some of what we've got there. And if you're interested, you can click some links and get over to, we have stuff on literature and spelling, and we go from there. But our basic program, yourchildcanwrite.com, student writing intensive, very effective. And you can also give us a call at 800-856-5815, 800-856-5815.
Well, thanks for coming on the show.
It's been a great pleasure.
And we'll be right back after these important announcements.